Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. We provide you with everything you need to know for total performance, fat loss, recovery, digestion, sleep, brain, and hormone optimization. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you just want to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield here, and as I've talked about a few times before on podcasts and my articles, I drink kombucha. I actually drink kombucha, I would say probably almost every day, as long as it's around and in the pantry. I personally don't actually get kombucha from the store, and we'll probably talk a little bit about why during this episode, but my wife actually ferments kombucha at home with like a home kombucha fermenting kit, and then she adds things like blueberries and ginger and all sorts of things that make it taste good and add a few antioxidants to it and also basically enhance the health properties that are already in kombucha. But there are a lot of myths and there are a lot of mistruths out there when it comes to kombucha. If you don't pick your poison wisely when it comes to this stuff, you can wind up getting fat or throwing your blood sugar out of balance or doing a lot of things that really aren't healthy, despite it being on the shelf of just about every health food store out there. So you can call that a kombucha confusion, if you will. And I know a lot of folks wonder, like, is this stuff alcoholic? Can kids drink it? Is it dangerous to make? Like, can you get toxins and things like that if you try to make bacterial-rich kombucha at home? Does it affect candida or bacterial overgrowth in your gut? What kind should you choose at the grocery store if you're going to get it at the grocery store? How should you feel after you drink it? All sorts of things. So today we're going to answer all those questions and more because I have a guest who goes by the title of the Kombucha Mama, and her name is Hannah Crum. And Hannah is the founder of something called Kombucha Camp, which is actually the most visited website in the world for kombucha info, kombucha recipes, kombucha advice, and pretty much everything you need to know about kombucha. She's what's called a master brewer, which I didn't actually know existed until I started to research Hannah. And she mentors thousands of folks who want to become kombucha brewers or just learn a little bit about kombucha. So she's the founder of Kombucha Brewers International, which is this nonprofit association that promotes bottled kombucha around the world. And she's actually got this really cool kombucha instructional video series over at Expert Village on YouTube. It's got over 1 million views. And in just a second, I'll tell you the URL where you can go check out all this stuff. And she's a leader and featured speaker in the California Real Food Movement. And she uses what she calls the kombucha lifestyle as an introduction to fermenting foods and gut health and the human microbiome and bacteriosapiens and some of the things that we'll also talk about on today's show. So she has kits, she has kombucha brewing packages, she has like kombucha do-it-yourself guides as well. So her video series, her website, her free guides, all of that, I'm going to put it over in the show notes for today's episode, which you can find over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/kombucha. So, Hannah, thank you for coming on the call today.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to hear that you're a kombucha lover.
I am a kombucha lover. And, you and I met at the Ancestral Health Symposium this year, where, there are plenty of healthy ancestral foods around. And of course, one of the things that we talked about at that symposium is the human gut and, where bacteria fits in when it comes to the human gut. So I think that might be a good place to jump in before we even start to talk about kombucha is, why bacteria is important and, why you kind of have this mission to heal the world, what you call one gut at a time on your website. So can you get into bacteria, the gut, and why that is important?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite topics. And, you know, to be honest, Ben, I didn't really know much about this topic until I started drinking kombucha, learning about it. And it's kind of led me on this journey of discovery to what I call, you know, what it means to be a human being. And that sounds like a really huge topic to tackle, maybe very philosophical, but essentially kind of what I've derived from my studies and from, you know, attending Ancestral Health Symposium and these other great informational websites like yours and the others out there is that we are bacteria-powered organisms, that every single cell in our body relies on bacteria to exchange DNA information, to create, to be catalysts for processes that literally fuel every single cell in our body. So when I discovered that, that was such a revelation because what it meant to me is that we are being bacteria powered, that's our force field. And it makes so much sense when we kind of see how much the levels of disease, of autoimmune disease, have risen, the farther away we've gotten from being in touch with our bacterial brethren.
So is that what bacteriosapiens means when you use that term? Or did you make that up, or is that an actual word?
No, it's a made up word. Okay. Bacteriosapiens, because it encapsulates our relationship to bacteria, I think. You know, mm-hmm. As human beings, we literally cannot function without them, in the good ones, of course, that are helping to support our functioning. And in fact, even some of the bad ones, you know, Candida albicans, E. coli, you know, some of these, H. pylori, live in our body, but when they're in balance, when they're in the right amounts, they serve a very specific function that actually supports our health. It's when we get out of balance that we end up with a lot of physical issues and you know, things like candida. Like, it's not that candida itself is bad, but when it gets out of balance and it overgrows in your system and it literally takes over and starts telling you to eat sugar, starts controlling your mind, and convincing you to eat foods that help support the growth of that bacteria or yeast rather than what is going to support your optimum functioning, that's when we kind of see just how powerful this relationship is.
So that's one sign or symptom of a bacterial overgrowth or a bacterial problem would be like the sugar cravings. And, you know, I know that alcohol cravings are another thing that can go along with candida overgrowth. But what are some of the other things that people would feel or experience if their bacteria was out of balance?
General feelings of not good, basically. So when our bodies are out of balance, we experience gut dysbiosis. Gut dysbiosis manifests in a variety of different ways. And this is why kombucha and many of these other fermented foods seemingly perform these, you know, near miraculous functions, because they help with so many different symptoms. So for instance, in terms of gut dysbiosis, IBS, not being able to digest our food properly, poor bowel movements, constipation, you know, all of this is one of the aspects of gut dysbiosis. Then you have things like autoimmune, such as eczema, psoriasis, the ways in which the skin reacts to the things that are disrupted in the body and how those manifest physically. And so when we realize that the root cause of disease is diet and stress, it makes a lot more sense why something like a kombucha, like a kefir, like a kvass, like a sauerkraut can come in and create this almost near immediate benefit to the body, because it's helping to bring that balance back into a body that's out of balance.
Interesting. So when it comes to bacteria and introducing bacteria to your body, why is it that kombucha is one of the things that you've chosen to focus on? What is it about the bacteria in kombucha? I know we'll get into what kombucha is here in a little bit, but why kombucha?
Kombucha is an entry point. It's not a destination. It's a way into kind of this bigger world that is all around us, this bacterial world. For me, it happened, I call it kombucha kismet. I had a moment of encounter with kombucha that I had no idea was even going to happen. I was visiting a friend from college in San Francisco. We got a tour of their very groovy place. This is back in like 2003. And one of the stops on the tour was this box. And in the box were jars. And the jars were covered with towels. And they go, "That's the kombucha." Never heard of it. Never. We didn't even try it. It wasn't ready to drink or anything. But I came back to LA. You know, there's a Whole Foods. They had kombucha all over the place back then in LA, and I grabbed a bottle of Gingerade, and it was love at first sip. I mean, it was like I can still remember the moment as if the light from heaven shone down upon me when I was drinking this. And of course, in my imagination, that's how I remember it. But really, there was an instant resonance with the flavor. It was sour. It was something that I really liked. And it reminded me of the pickle juice I used to sneak out of the pickle jar growing up. My mom would always admonish me for that. And there was a vibrancy to it that just literally hooked me. And here's the funny thing, Ben, is I was not into cooking. I was not the kind of person who would normally take on this kind of project. So for me to adopt this culture and raise it in my home and nurture it the way that I have for so many years was really kind of a first step outside of my normal comfort zone. And that's why I like to think of kombucha as an entry point into these bigger things, such as, you know, understanding process, understanding that good things come to those who wait and you reap what you sow. And I know those are kind of trite aphorisms, but when we get down to the truth of what they're saying, it really is true. You know, we're kind of programmed the opposite to have an expectation of instant gratification and or instant healing or here, take this pill and now you're cured. But that's not how our bodies work and that's not how the world works. So by engaging in a process that helps to get back to that type of trusting the cycles and going with that flow and knowing that what you're putting into something will reap rewards down the road is just an exciting process to engage in.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. I mean, the gut is like a garden, right? So like by me drinking kombucha every day and introducing, you know, I do a wide variety of fermented foods and I suppose you probably do too, since you know the importance of bacteria, but you know, kimchi, sauerkraut, kombucha, and even different strains of kombucha, different, you know, varieties of probiotics, you know, and I also do kefir and, you know, you mentioned kvass and I drink kvass and, you know, that's, I think one of the keys is to understand that, you know, if you wander out to your garden, you don't necessarily have to plant just one variety. You would plant a wide variety of different things that you can eat, and you don't expect them to all pop up at once, right? Like you grow, you nourish, you feed that garden, and gradually it begins to thrive. And I think that that's one of the things people need to realize about bacteria, right? Is I know that the human gut can begin to change within like one day of changing your diet. It's crazy. Have you seen this about the gut microbiome and how it just like adapts so quickly?
Absolutely. And yeah. I love this metaphor that you're using with the garden, because here's the thing, Ben, and we know this instinctively, but we don't always remember it consciously, is nature loves diversity. Mm-hmm. You never go out in outside, even if you walk out your front door. I'm in a major city, Los Angeles. I walk out my front door. There's palm trees, there's grass, there's roses, there's bugs, there's birds. You know, nobody lives in a place where there's only one thing, because yeah, nature loves diversity. And so when in talking about the soil and the gut being the human soil, right? And so we need to plant the bacteria that help nutrify our organism so that it can function properly. And just like we put fertilizers or we put, you know, something into our garden that's going to help nurture the soil and nurture the bacteria in the soil, because that's again how plants eat too. Like literally our entire planet is bacteria powered. You know, plants uptake nutrition by bacteria passing nutrition through the little roots that they have off of them, just as we're nutrified by the bacteria that live in our gut and create all those catalytic reactions. And to speak to diversity, there's over 500 different types of bacteria that live in our gut alone. And it varies from person to person. It's like a fingerprint in a way. The type of signatures that they're uncovering through this research is really exciting. To know that there's this level of diversity, not only within my gut, but in everybody's gut. So,
yeah, I like it. So obviously there's a lot of reasons out there to introduce bacterial rich foods into your diet and to nourish your body, just like a garden, to be patient and to be in this for the long run as you change the bacterial balance in your gut. Now, I think it's going to be fun here to jump into brass tacks and start off with this question, Hannah. What is kombucha? Because I know there's some people listening in for whom it's this mysterious beverage that they grab off of the shelf at Whole Foods and drink and know it's supposed to be good for them but have no clue where it comes from. So what is kombucha?
kombucha is fermented tea. So just like when we make beet kvass, we're using beets and a little bit of starter. The starter is on the skin of the beet, just like in a sauerkraut, the bacteria come from that. In the case of fermenting tea, we use a starter culture. So similar to like a sourdough bread or a kefir grain, these are all cultures that we place into a substrate or medium. It then ferments that into a healthy beverage. So in the case of kombucha, we're putting it into tea. Now tea, which is Camellia sinensis, it's a specific plant. I know we have a tendency to think, you know, peppermint tea and chamomile tea, those are actually herbal tisanes. But the tea plant itself, from which green, black, white, yellow, you know, all the other types of tea come from, has very specific antioxidants and polyphenols that help support optimum functioning in the body. Now, when we expose that tea to a fermentation process with the kombucha culture, it makes those elements even more bioavailable. It breaks them down into smaller components that are easier for our bodies to absorb. So we're receiving nutrition in a living form. We're receiving nutrition in a form our bodies have evolved to recognize. And we're receiving nutrition that can be instantly utilized. And so a lot of times when people grab a kombucha off the shelf, the thing we hear people say most often is, it just makes me feel good. Mm-hmm. And when you realize it's the bacteria, it's the probiotics from the bacteria, it's the yeast present, have all of the B vitamins in a living form. Now, granted, these are in very trace amounts. So this isn't something where you'd be looking on the back looking for your RDA of all of your B vitamins. But again, being in that living form is something that I think is really crucial because, as you know, Ben, probably from studying fitness, you know, our bodies are kind of like a puzzle pieces in that the chemicals, the nutrition, the vitamins, et cetera, are in specific shapes. And when those shapes plug in, our body can uptake and instantly know what to do with those. And the reason that people have such a problem these days is there are so many shapes in our food that our bodies don't recognize. Mm. And any of those shapes that it doesn't recognize, like GMOs or artificial sweeteners or artificial colors, the body assumes is then being attacked by those things. And so when we consume products that aren't in a whole living form or that have a lot of additives to them, our body doesn't know what to do with it. And this is why we see such a huge incidence in the autoimmune disease, especially the more we consume it, right? You know, if you eat a GMO bag of chips once, you're probably going to be okay. It's not the end of the world. But if you're eating them on a regular basis, it's that cumulative effect that throws the body out of balance. And it works hard to try to keep up as much as it can until all of a sudden you have an illness or all of a sudden, you know, your body has to send you a much larger message to get it through that, hey, this stuff you're putting in your body isn't working and we're not functioning anymore.
So on a very, very basic level, like if somebody wanted to make kombucha, what would be just like the most basic recipe that they would use? Where would they get the ingredients? What ingredients would they need? And what's kind of the process to go from that tea that you talked about to fermenting it and then having a final batch of kombucha in a bottle or a jar?
You know, here's the thing, Ben, if you can brew a cup of tea, you can brew kombucha. It is literally that easy. So basically, instead of brewing one cup of tea, we're brewing a gallon of tea. So we use 3 to 5 tea bags or 3 to 5 teaspoons of loose leaf tea per gallon. We soak that in our hot water for about 15 minutes. We remove the tea bags, add 1 cup of sugar. So it's 1 cup per gallon is our basic ratio. Now that's a lot of sugar, but when you taste the final product, you'll notice that it has a sweet tart flavor, and that's because the sugar is broken down through the fermentation process. So 1 cup of sugar with our 3 to 5 tea bags, we stir that up, and then we add a kombucha culture.
Can I interrupt you for just a second?
Please.
When you say that the sugars are broken down by the fermentation process, does that mean that if excessive sugars aren't added, that the bacteria have actually consumed and metabolized that sugar rather than you consuming and metabolizing that sugar?
Correct. And so the sugar is not for you. The sugar is for the yeast. It's for the bacteria. So the yeast start breaking down the sugar from, sucrose is a polysaccharide.
Mm-hmm.
It's a disaccharide. So it's fructose and glucose that create the sucrose molecule. So the yeast start consuming the sucrose and cleaving it into fructose and glucose. those then become fuel sources for the bacteria, which create glucuronic acid. So they need that glucose molecule present in order to create those healthy acids that help detoxify the body and bring it back into balance gradually. Then the fructose is also utilized by the yeast. So by the time it ends up to you, even if you're looking at the grams of sugar listed on the label, it's not equivalent to, say, you know, teaspoons, or, you know, if you had table sugar, they're not equivalent, because although there's still some sugar present, it's in a form that's much easier on the body. It has a lower glycemic load. And in fact, there's been a lot of anecdotal evidence as well as some research showing that diabetics and people who can't handle a lot of sugar, provided they're doing a longer fermentation process, in fact, it helps them to balance their blood sugar levels.
Okay, gotcha. So that sugar that you're adding as you brewed the tea before you bottle this stuff up, it's basically not something that you need to worry about from like a glycemic index standpoint.
Exactly right. And okay. You know, the way what we always tell people is, look, every body is different. As we've just been talking about, my microbiome is different from yours, is different from someone else's. So how kombucha affects my body is going to potentially be different from how it affects your body. And this is due to a variety of factors, such as the state your body is in already. What else is going on? Do you have other health issues? So, for instance, some people, when they drink kombucha, they feel like they're having some kind of reaction to the kombucha. More often than not, this is what we call a Herxheimer reaction or a healing crisis, where, and this occurs anytime you start some type of detox protocol, where basically the body gets into a stage where it's ready to release the toxins. And as it releases those toxins in your body before they've been flushed, you experience those symptoms as if you had, you know, for example, in candida, you might have a flare-up where you have, it seems to get worse before it gets better. And that's because, look, these are organisms that you're trying to kill off and outcompete by putting other organisms in there, and they're fighting for their lives. And they're going to try to hang on as long as they can. And this is where we bring in not just our gut and how it feels, but our brain and our knowledge and education. And when we combine those two things, we're able to engage in a more full feedback process. So gotcha. When we start to connect what goes in my mouth with how it makes my body feel and start to connect the dots on that, that's when people are able to make real shifts, because they can recognize, oh, when I eat that, actually that makes me not feel so great. Maybe I should cut down on that.
So I interrupted you as you were going into the part about adding sugar into the tea. Can you finish with the kombucha recipe?
Absolutely. So, okay, we have our tea, we have our sugar. Then we add our culture. So your kombucha culture, it's always good to source one from a quality, reputable source. Reason being, you don't know what kind of conditions they're grown in. You want to make sure it's something that's clean and isn't potentially contaminated. And more than that, because kombucha does have quite a few defense mechanisms, it's support. Because so often, like, think about this. If you were making yogurt at home, would you ever be afraid of the yogurt or of the sauerkraut? Now, I know you're a fermentationist, Ben, but there is something about kombucha that inherently freaks people out, because they're just not used to seeing this funky little culture. It's bacterial cellulose that the bacteria, basically what the bacteria do is they throw out these nanofibers of culture that then bond together. And as they bond together, they create a very tight layer. And that's your SCOBY. SCOBY stands for symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. So the bacteria
really?
Build.
See, I
the
always, I never knew that that was what SCOBY actually stands for. So SCOBY, symbiotic
yes.
culture of bacteria and yeast.
You got it. Yeah.
I always thought it was just like a shortening of whatever the scientific term is for the big clump of fibers that floats stuff. There on top of the jar.
Well, it used to be called mushroom tea, and just like we think of kefir grains, but they're not actually grains, mushroom was more of a descriptor that described the kind of – it looked kind of like a mushroom cap, right? If you can imagine, it's all white and thick, and that's what people identified it as. SCOBY is a term that obviously is more accurate, but certainly is an acronym. So lots of things can be SCOBYs, but SCOBY is the term that was invented for kombucha.
Okay, gotcha. So is that it for the kombucha recipe once you've got all this stuff bottled up?
Right. So then you throw your SCOBY in there. Now, the important thing is starter liquid. You need to have 1 cup of very strong starter liquid. Starter liquid is simply fermented kombucha. So like if, when you're making your next batch, like when your wife makes her next batch, she probably reserves a cup of liquid right off the top. And that becomes the starter for her next batch.
And the very, the very first starter that she used, she just bought a bottle of kombucha from the grocery store and used that as the starter.
Well, and some kombuchas you can do that with. Now, here's the issue that we've run into because of what happened in 2010. In 2010, several brands of kombucha were removed from the shelves because kombucha is a fermented product, it can contain trace amounts of alcohol, although typically we don't see it any more than, say, a glass of fruit juice or something like that. However, when we add fruit to our kombucha, what we're doing is we're reactivating the fermentation process. So the yeast, now that they have a sugar source present again, starts converting the sugars from that. It also pulls all of the healthy elements from whatever you're infusing into it. So say blueberries, you're getting your antioxidants, your flavonoids, all that good stuff. And that's why it'll turn your kombucha a really lovely purple color, because it's just pulling all that good stuff right out of there. The problem is, though, if you have that in an anaerobic environment and you don't give it time for the bacteria to then consume the ethanol created, you end up with levels that are potentially outside of what the current legally allowed limit is. So in response to that, the companies had to change their process in how they make kombucha. So this is very similar to what we see in commercial yogurt, right? Commercial yogurt has a couple of strains that have been defined as the specific strains for yogurt, but they're not nearly as diverse versus when we make yogurt at home from a true yogurt culture, which has 30 plus strains of bacteria present. So oftentimes we're able to potentially grow a culture or create a starter, but many people say that subsequent batches simply don't have the same flavor and over time aren't as delicious as when you procure a starter from either a reputable source or a good friend or, you know, something like that. So,
gotcha. Okay. So I want to ask you in a little bit here where we get the, you know, some of these things like the starter and the culture. But before I do that, you talked about how once you've got your tea and your sugar, you add your starter. And then what's the next step?
Give it a week.
1 week.
7 days. 7 days is our, okay, so in our ideal brewing conditions, the temperature is 75 to 85 with 78 to 80 being our sweet spot. So kombucha does like it on the warmer side. But if we're in that 1 gallon at those ideal temperatures, about 7 days is what it takes to turn that into something that most people find delicious. So it's going to be a balance between sweet and tart, and everybody's taste preference is different. And that's what's great about making it at home is you decide when it has the flavor you like. You get to add the flavorings at the end that you prefer best. And you can get so experimental crazy, people really come up with lots of fun stuff. One of the wackier flavors I made was a bacon booch. We did a maple bacon booch. So we took actual pieces of bacon and infused it into the kombucha with a little bit of maple syrup. And it's pretty tasty stuff.
Wow. Do you have that recipe posted on your website?
I don't, but it's pretty simple. You know, we have a book coming out in 2015. My husband and I are co-authors on that, and we're also partners at Kombucha Camp. So so we're really excited about that coming out next November.
Cool. Okay, so I want to do a few rapid-fire questions to you.
Yes.
Because I get a lot of questions about kombucha, and since you're the expert, I want to hear what your thoughts are. You talked on this a little bit just now as far as alcohol content goes, but of course there's that whole Lindsay Lohan story where she got pulled over and she blamed the fact that she bought a kombucha, I think at Whole Foods, for the fact that her blood levels of alcohol were above the acceptable limit for driving. Is kombucha, like if you buy kombucha from the grocery store or you make it yourself, is it alcoholic? And if so, how high?
Sure. So as I mentioned, kombucha is a naturally fermented beverage, and as such, it does create trace amounts of alcohol. See, these fermented drinks, Ben, are our original soft drinks, right? There's hard liquor and soft drinks because all of the, you know, water kefir, milk kefir, all of these have trace amounts of alcohol naturally present. That alcohol serves a very specific function. And this is something we've kind of lost sight of in post-prohibition United States alcohol culture, is that alcohol is medicine, first and foremost. It is what we infused herbs into that created our first tinctures that we see derivations of in things like Jägermeister and whatnot that have these very strong herbal flavors to them. But originally, these serve very specific medicinal functions. So kombucha certainly has nowhere near the alcohol levels that you'll find in a hard alcohol. So all of these kind of soft drinks, right, your root beers, your ginger ales, all these naturally fermented beverages topped out at no more than 2%. So the alcohol levels in kombucha are self-limiting because the bacteria consume the ethanol produced by the yeast, thereby reducing the ethanol and increasing the healthy acid content. So this makes measuring alcohol in kombucha incredibly difficult because a lot of the machinery, there's no like litmus test where we can just like put a little piece of paper and, oh, okay, this has that. It's a much more complex process than that. But suffice to say, because of the reformulation, now there are companies out there, all the companies that are out there selling an under 21 product, they are within that legally prescribed limit. There are brands of kombucha that are called over 21, and in fact, GT's has both an under and over 21. Those you might have to be carded for, but the funny thing is they don't tend to have, again, more than that 2% alcohol. So in terms of inebriation, which is what you were asking about, can it get you drunk? I mean, it just really depends on your body. First of all, the way in which FDR tried to end prohibition was he said that beer that had a 3.2 alcohol by weight was considered non-inebriating and therefore could be sold. And this is what then allowed them to sell other alcohol and end prohibition. So the government already set up a standard that that is an acceptable limit that's considered non-inebriating. Other people have reported that when they take B vitamin shots, the feeling of euphoria that they get is very similar to drinking a kombucha. Mm-hmm. Remember, we mentioned earlier there's yeast in kombucha and it contains all of the B vitamins in a living form. So is the buzz that people are getting due to alcohol? Is it due to B vitamins? I think it varies person to person. Some people who are very sensitive to alcohol may report feeling a sensation of it, whereas others never feel any kind of quote-unquote buzz ever. So so most people find that drinking kombucha is not something that's going to impair them. In fact, I think almost 100% of people would find that. But, you know, everybody is different, and we always like to allow for individuals. But for the most part, we find it's something that people give to children. They do perfectly great. Do your kids drink kombucha, Ben?
They do drink kombucha, and that was actually my next question, now that we've got the alcohol issue out of the way, is should kids drink it? Is it okay?
Absolutely. See, here's the other thing about all those fermented beverages I mentioned before. They were also called small beers, and they were given to children. So, again, we live in an anomaly in history where we have this very puritanical attitude towards alcohol, in that we treat it like a controlled substance, and unfortunately, that's how it ends up in our culture as being viewed, instead of as something that is that we evolved with. We evolved with alcohol, with all of these bacterial fermentations, and it provides a very specific benefit. So we call this healthy low alcohol, just to kind of cast it in a more positive light. And numerous studies point to moderate consumption of alcohol as lengthening life. It's also something that we see in other countries where, you know, even after a woman gives birth, she'll be given beer, because unfiltered beer, again, contains all those B vitamins. It relaxes the mother. It allows for the breast milk to flow. And so there's a lot of health benefits to it that we simply don't totally understand in this country. So children love it. Pregnant women can drink it. Again, it's listening to your body. I've had friends who were pregnant, and they love kombucha. They got pregnant, and they couldn't stand the smell of it. Listen to your body.
Okay.
I've had other women tell me they drank it. It helped their breast milk flow. They craved it all through their pregnancy. They loved it. So it really is trusting your gut. You are the captain of your ship. You are in charge of what goes in. You are the one who experiences how everything reacts in your body. So it's really up to you to make that decision and see, is kombucha something that fits for me? Is it something that's going to work for me? Because here's another interesting study that recently came out, and I don't know if you're following these, Ben, but there's a bunch of bacteria studies coming out. One of them showed that alcoholics who had poor diversity of bacteria in their guts had a harder time recovering from alcoholism versus those who had a more diverse microbiome. So kombucha is something that many people have reported curbs their alcohol cravings.
Mm.
So it could be by getting the healthy bacteria that we need, we then aren't craving
right.
You know what we think we need in a more toxifying format, especially when consumed in higher doses.
Okay, got it. Next question: can you drink too much kombucha? And I ask this question because it seems that whether I am drinking kombucha from the grocery store or I'm drinking my wife's homemade kombucha, if I drink more than about a decent sized bottle's worth, I tend to get some bloating and some gas. Is that because I've overdone it on kombucha, or is that just coincidence?
You know, it's again trusting your gut. And if you feel the two are connected, then I would sense that they are. And kombucha is a tonic. So it's something that is best consumed in small, frequent doses.
Mm.
So, for instance, 4 to 8 ounces first thing in the morning on an empty stomach is a great way to start. It allows you to feel how the kombucha is working in your body. And then from there, you do that 1 to 3 times a day. So drinking a bottle from the store, that's 16 ounces, there's two potential servings right there. So having more than that, maybe your body naturally tops off at that level. I'm the kombucha mama. I don't even drink kombucha every day. I do almost most days, but then there's some days where my body just doesn't crave it, and I listen to my body. So, and then there's times when I don't have it for a little while, and then I'm like, oh my gosh, I gotta have a kombucha. I'm dying for that nutrition. So, you know, it really is that observation of your body and trusting that you're able to interpret the information correctly.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. So, kind of on the same vein of gas and bloating, we've talked about candida a few times, and I'm sure that you've gotten this question before. There are people out there in the healthosphere that say that kombucha is something you shouldn't drink if you have bacterial overgrowth or if you have candida. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I hate to harp on it, but trust your gut. And here's why. Kombucha does contain specific acids that are known candidicides. It creates phenylethyl alcohol. It creates caprylic acid. So these things are already known to have an anti-candida effect. It also creates other antimicrobials and things like that. Here's the problem. As I mentioned before, sometimes it gets worse before it gets better. And people who are not prepared to go through the process of a die-off situation or who don't know what's happening in that situation may incorrectly interpret those, you know, it might be gas, bloating, it could be cramps, it could be headache, it could be just kind of feeling out of sorts. Any of those symptoms can be misinterpreted as the kombucha is making me sick. And it's by listening to your body, trusting the information you're getting, and also applying your conscious brain to, hey, what's going on with my body? What is it I need to correct? Because oftentimes people who have out of control sugar cravings and alcohol cravings can't stand the taste of sour when that's exactly what they need to get their bodies back on track. So for some people, when they take that first sip, they're like, oh, this is bleh. But their bodies will bring them back around to it because instinctually the human organism knows, hey, this is something that's good for me and I want more of it. And this is why we'll also see some people who first start drinking kombucha crave a lot of it. Their bodies are missing something. So by listening to what your body needs, you're able to flush. Now, people who do experience a Herxheimer reaction, as I mentioned before, the simplest thing to do, reduce the amount of kombucha you're drinking, increase the amount of water you're drinking. Flushing is going to help to get those toxins out of your body and then gradually add it back in as you're able to. Now, some people find that adding kombucha right from the top isn't going to work for them. And that's when going back to a lacto-ferment, like a kefir or kvass or something like that is going to be a little bit gentler. It's a higher pH. It's a different type of organism. It allows the gut to heal in a different way first before then adding in the detox properties of kombucha as well as the acetic acid that comes from it being an acetic acid ferment.
Okay, got it. Cool. So essentially what you're saying is that a lot of times when you feel symptoms like if you have candida or you have bacterial overgrowth, it is probably just a detox, Herxheimer's, die-off reaction, and not the fact that you are feeding a bunch of the candida and yeast and fungus with the kombucha.
Now, let me make a caveat here. If you are brewing it at home and you're not allowing it to ferment long enough, then you might be inadvertently feeding your body sugar. So
yeah, because the bacteria hasn't had a chance to eat all the sugar. So you're eating the sugar. It's feeding the yeast and the fungus in your gut.
Exactly right. And so for candida sufferers and for diabetics and for people who have sugar sensitivities, we need to be conscious that we're fermenting it long enough. So in that case, that same gallon of kombucha that we mentioned was ready in 7 days, we'd give it 10 to 14 days for someone like that. Now, if they find that the kombucha is like too sour to drink for their palate, dilute it with water. It's like a little bit of lemon in your water. You still get the probiotic benefit. That's also a great trick for helping people who are addicted to sodas to get off of soda is start sneaking the kombucha in with the soda. They're at least going to start receiving some of that probiotic benefit, some of that stuff that's going to help signal their body, hey, time to let go of this addiction and incorporate a healthier beverage into their lifestyle.
Okay. Next question. When I buy something like GT's kombucha or some of these other kombucha strains at the grocery store, they taste much sweeter than what we make at home. And they seem to have a relatively high calorie count when you look at the nutrition label, like, you know, 35 calories and that's per serving. And there's two servings in a bottle or sometimes as high as 70 calories. So you're getting basically as many calories as a can of soda when you drink one of these kombuchas that are at the grocery store. Now, is that sugar, sugar that has not been fermented by the bacteria because it didn't ferment long enough? Is it sugar that they've added after they've made the kombucha? Or why is it that these taste so much sweeter and have such a high calorie count?
Well, you're hitting on, you know, the nation's current addiction to sugar, which has been created by the processed foods industry. We think of sodas and, you know, things like that as simulacrum. Basically, these are imitation foods designed to imitate natural foods that give a nutritional benefit, and yet these foods deliver zero nutritional benefit. So, for instance, carbonation. Carbonation is a natural byproduct of the fermentation process that instinctually humans understand means that B vitamins are present because yeast is present. And when we look at soda, soda has added carbonation. Kombucha has healthy acids that detoxify the body. Sodas have fake acids that destroy the body because it removes healthy elements from the body. So they, on the surface of it, if you tested the pH or this or that, you might think, oh, these things are identical. But the fact that the sugars are pre-digested, that you have bacteria in a living form, and that you have these trace amounts of vitamins and minerals in a living form, it far outweighs any kind of calorie count you're looking at on the can itself. That's the first thing I would say is...
Wait,
is,
so what you're saying is that when they list sugars or calories on the label, does that mean that they're listing sugars and calories that were added as a process of fermentation?
Well, so there's a couple different things that might be going on with commercial kombuchas, and not all commercial kombuchas are made the same way. It's very similar to craft beer. You know, you can have how many different kinds of Hefeweizen and they all taste different, right? So kombucha is a very similar product in that way. It's a craft product. It's brewed. It's fermented. What we see, this natural variation and the sweetness that we're seeing is because they're trying to create a product that fits a mainstream palate. Not everybody is ready to dive into the, you know, apple cider vinegar sour end of the kombucha spectrum. And so having these, what we call bridge brands, having these bridge brands that help with a slightly lighter profile or a slightly sweeter profile allows people to get into the habit of kombucha, to get accustomed to the healthy bacteria present. And what most people find, especially if they're making it at home, is that whereas before maybe they liked it on the sweeter side, over time they tend to make it more and more sour. Because that is actually what the body craves. You know, we crave sour, we crave bitter. These are the things that keep our body functioning properly. The sweets are just supposed to be the little sprinkles on top. But unfortunately, the way our system is set up, those sweets have become pervasive, and that's part of what is creating so many digestive issues. So the sugar calories you're seeing on those commercial bottles, sometimes it's coming from stevia or other things that are added after the fact to make the product more palatable. Most time, especially if it's an unflavored, those sugars are simply reflecting the remaining sugar from the fermentation process. And again, it'll look high, but it won't taste sweet.
The remaining sugar that wasn't actually fermented by the bacteria?
Well, and here's the thing, Ben, is do you know much about food labels or how they're made?
Yeah.
Well, so they don't actually test the product itself for those components. They look at the ingredients list and they pull known quantities and make a calculation based on that. So if in kombucha we list out that it's made with tea, sugar, da-da-da-da-da, there's no accounting for the fermentation process. And so you may be seeing sugar counts, sugar grams that are higher than what's actually present in the bottle because it's not testing that specific product.
Interesting. So They're getting a list of all the ingredients that went into, say, like GT's kombucha. Let's say like that, you know, one really popular flavor is like the trilogy, GT's kombucha. They're seeing what went into that. They're seeing that they put, okay, X amount of sugar in here to ferment the bacteria. They're putting that amount of sugar on the nutrition label, but much of that sugar that you see on that nutrition label might actually be fermented.
See, this is, and I can't say from one brand to another how exactly their labels are made, what I can say is that there's not a uniform like lab that everything goes to, and that those exact values is what's passed on to the label.
Okay, got it.
It's kind of nebulous.
Yeah, I wonder if it'd be interesting to get to see someone do this experiment. If you're listening in, you may want to do this. You know, figure out how to get like a burn calorimeter or some other way that you could just take a bottle of kombucha off the shelf and test how much of the sugar is really truly present as sugar versus how much of it is just stuff that's already been fermented by bacteria.
I mean, and this is like lab type stuff where lots of testing has to be done and it all has to be centrifuged out and figured out, you know, the weight of this and that, you know, so it's a very complex process, which is why we don't see it done very much. But this is my point being, like, let's not get hung up on the sugar grams on the kombucha bottle. Let's be excited that we're drinking a kombucha and not a soda and not a sugar-laden juice that might be pasteurized. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're reaching for something that's good for you. If it tastes good to you too, I mean, provided your body is having a positive reaction to it and you're not, you know, seeing your health get out of control, I think it's safe to assume that those are, you know, those are things we don't need to worry about.
Are you pretty familiar with all the different brands that are out there all over the grocery stores?
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
so,
as you mentioned, Kombucha Brewers International is a nonprofit trade association that Alex and I co-founded to bring all of the kombucha bottling companies together to strategize, to have a safe space to talk about the issues that concern the kombucha industry.
So if you were going to go to the grocery store and get kombucha and it wasn't something that you'd made yourself at home, what would be your top brand/brands if you were just going to buy one from like Whole Foods or Sprouts or, you know, Nuggets or some other organic grocery store?
Well, first of all, I always love to find out what the local brand is. So whenever I'm traveling somewhere, if I hit the local health food store or the co-op or wherever, I want to grab what's local because, you know, living in LA, I have a lot of access to different kombuchas, but because it's that craft product, you know, every brand tastes different. So I always love to taste what's local. And then in terms of, you know, favorite brands, like here in LA, I really love Health Aid. They've got they do farmers market juices. They have a beet kombucha. I really like the savory flavors. In Wisconsin, I really like Nasala kombucha. And if I'm in the Southeast, I like Bucci. It has a little more of the tang to it. You know, I have to admit, I'm a sour girl. So for me, the more tartness, the better, at least for my taste buds. That's what I like.
Okay, got it. So you like to look for the local. You like to look for the tart.
And then if I don't find it, you know, GT's is great to reach for. I particularly like the Over 21 brand with the black labels. But, you know, in a pinch, the Under 21 stuff is good too. Because, you know, more often than not, if I can grab a kombucha, there's almost nothing else on the shelf that doesn't have added sugar in it. Even iced tea seems to have sugar in it wherever I go.
So just a few more questions here for you. Number one, what is the biggest mistake that you see people make when they're making their own kombucha at home? is it not sterilizing the equipment properly, so you set yourself up for some kind of an infection or food poisoning? Is it not fermenting long enough, adding too much sugar, adding not enough? Like, what would be the biggest mistake that you see?
There's a couple of them. So the first one would be trying to use one culture in too large of a batch of sweet tea. So just like when we scale our cake or cookie recipe or whatever recipe we're making, we need those ingredients to remain in the correct ratio, or we end up with, you know, a baking disaster. The same is true with kombucha. If we put one culture that's intended for 1 gallon into 2 gallons of sweet tea, there's an off chance it might survive, but you're asking that culture to do an awful lot of work in converting all that sugar and acidifying the brew before other microorganisms colonize. So not having the correct amount of kombucha and starter liquid is one mistake. A second mistake is not adding enough sugar, because like you said, people are like, oh, well, I'll just reduce the amount of sugar and then it won't have as much sugar. The problem is the sugar is not for you. And if you don't give the yeast and bacteria what they need, they can't then create the healthy acids that makes you feel good. And then the third thing I'd say is heat. That temperature range is very specific, that 75 to 85 with 78 to 80 being our sweet spot. All of the information for, you know, the quantities of the sugar, the temperature, all of this comes from the numerous amounts of studies that have been done on kombucha since the 1850s. So kombucha has been very prolifically studied for hundreds of years, well, 150 years or so. And but a lot of those studies take place outside of the United States. And so the information that often gets quoted is, oh, there's no studies on kombucha, which just isn't true. So a lot of this information comes directly from those studies in terms of what those ideal conditions are. So you want to have enough culture and starter liquid. You want to give it the right amount of sugar. And you also want to make sure it has the right temperature. Now here, I just want to address the issue, because you mentioned a couple times about, is it dangerous? Can you contaminate yourself? Things like that. Because sometimes there is that misinformation that goes around about kombucha. So kombucha has several defense mechanisms that makes it very easy to make at home. First, let's think about it from a logical perspective. How could something like this funky little pancake get passed around for hundreds of years if it was so easy to make you sick? It simply wouldn't. People wouldn't be handing it out to their friends if it was something that then, you know, they might get sick from. So some of these defense mechanisms are, the first one is the pH. The pH of kombucha is very acidic. It's a 2.5 to 3.5 is what we typically see for kombucha. Even according to the FDA's website, something that has a pH of 4.6 or lower is considered a very safe food, because there's never been an instance of botulism. So it's a very safe food for that reason. Also, there have been studies showing its antimicrobial properties. So it'll kill things like E. coli and Salmonella on contact, just because of the acids, and they're able to break those cell membranes. So that low pH is really important. And that's why our starter liquid coming from the top is really vital, because that's what helps to acidify the brew and protect it. The second defense mechanism is the SCOBY itself. It creates a lid. So it's a lid that not only prevents other microorganisms from trying to land in this huge pot of sweet tea that any organism would want to consume, and then as the layer grows across the top, it literally grows so that it covers the entire surface. So your wife may have started with, you know, a starter that was really small, but if she moved it to a larger vessel, then the SCOBY would grow to that size of the vessel. So that lid also then prevents evaporation and creates an anaerobic environment for the other fermentation process to occur. So it's low pH, it's the SCOBY itself, and even the trace amounts of alcohol are naturally antimicrobial and act as a preservative. So all of those things working in concert make kombucha very safe and very easy to make at home.
Wow. And that's kind of the last thing I wanted to mention, was making this stuff yourself and all the resources that you have. And obviously I'm going to put a link to all this stuff over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/kombucha. But tell me about some of like the kits and the packages that you have for people who want to start making their own kombucha. Like, what would you recommend as far as all the different things that you have over on your kombucha web store?
Well, here's what I would say. If you know you love kombucha and you're serious about making it, go to Continuous Brew. It might feel like a large investment, but it's the same as when you're getting your dehydrator or your Vitamix. Once you pay for the piece of equipment, it makes that process a lot easier. So the Continuous Brew process is the easiest, safest, healthiest way to make kombucha. It's easy because you pour everything right out of the spigot. So instead of having to handle the culture all the time, potentially contaminating them, you know, you expose them to more risk by handling them more often. Now we don't touch them at all, except once every 3 to 6 months when we clean the vessel. And it's easy in the sense that when you drain some of that kombucha off, you top off with your sweet tea, and then it only takes a couple of days for that to turn into kombucha you can drink. So it's fast because once the vessel's set up, that fermentation process happens on a much more rapid schedule. The additional benefit to the continuous brew process is by leaving that 75% of kombucha in the vessel, there are other healthy acids created later in the fermentation process at the 15-day mark. And again, at the 30-day mark, we see those acids peak. Now, if we were doing 30 days in our gallon jar, you probably wouldn't like the way that tastes. Tasted and now you've defeated your purpose. But in the continuous brew process, because we're tempering it with the sweet tea, we get the full benefit of those healthy acids expressed, plus we're moderating the flavor with a little bit of that sweet tea, so you have a delicious drink full of good health benefits, and it's just a lot easier. It streamlines the whole process. So instead of having to lift your jars and pour them in through the funnels and this and that, everything comes right out of a spigot. It's super easy. All of our vessels are going to make delicious kombucha. The only one that'll have a different flavor is the oak barrel. So we have modern porcelain vessels. We have stainless steel with stainless steel spigots. And yes, they're corrosive resistant, and they're perfectly safe for brewing kombucha. We also have the oak barrel in two sizes, which lends a lovely flavor to the kombucha. It mellows the acetic bite a little bit, and many people comment they love the oaky flavor.
Sweet.
And then there's a handmade stoneware vessel with an all-wood spigot. So we've tried to accommodate a variety of people's needs. Some products are made in the USA, some are handmade, some have wood spigots, you know. So we're trying to offer a selection of products so that anyone can be successful with this hobby. And then if you found that kombucha is maybe not where you should start, we have other cultures. We've got water kefir grains, milk kefir grains, and then we also have jun. Have you ever heard of jun, Ben?
No, it's jun.
Or jun or jun tea is how they sometimes spell it.
How do you spell it?
J-U-N. Rhymes with fun is how we call it. But basically, it's a raw honey green tea ferment. So the kombucha culture is uniquely adapted to work with tea and sugar. And if you expose it to raw honey, the naturally occurring bacteria will compete with your kombucha culture, and you end up with off flavors. And I mean, frankly, it just smells gross. Jun is a culture that looks very similar, but behaves slightly differently because it's a different colony of bacteria and yeast, but it feeds off green tea and raw honey and creates this very light floral, lovely alternative to kombucha. So if people find kombucha is a little too intense, you might want to try the jun. If you find both of those are too intense for your gut at this time, start with the lacto ferments and ease your way into the acetobacter ferments.
Wow, this is so cool. All right, well, I'm going to put a link to all this stuff over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/kombucha. If I can twist Hannah's arm into sending me that maple bacon recipe, I would freaking love to have that published exclusively at bengreenfieldfitness.com. And if she sends it, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, Hannah, I will also put that in the show notes as well over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/kombucha. So now the pressure's on, Hannah.
Oh, my gosh.
Everybody's going to wait for it with bated breath.
Yes.
Okay, so Hannah, thank you so much for coming on the call today and sharing all this stuff with us.
Well, thank you, Ben. You know, it's always fun to talk to a fellow fermentation foodie.
Yeah.
How many more F's could I fit in there?
Yeah, exactly.
Fit fellow. So do you feel bacteria powered, Ben? Do you
fit like fellow
do you
fermentation
feel like you're,
foodie?
Exactly. Do you feel like the bacteria like powers you up?
Yes, and when I am traveling, because I'm a little bit more careful about drinking fermented foods and or drinking fermented beverages and eating fermented foods from which I'm unaware of the actual source, I can feel a difference. And I really don't like just popping a probiotic pill versus just eating all these different ancestral fermented foods. So I know that for those of you listening in, it can seem like a drag to make your own stuff, but you know what? Getting in touch with nature, getting in touch with your environment, getting in touch with your microbiome and how you're actually feeding that, rather than relying upon your local grocery store to determine what your microbiome is going to be like, I think it's really cool to take all of that into your own hands. And our household has certainly been a lot more healthy since we started doing it. So
I'm beaming. I'm excited. I love this.
Cool.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, Hannah, thank you so much for coming on. Folks, if you're listening in, head over to bengreenfieldfitness.com/kombucha. That's KOMBUCHA, kombucha, for the show notes. And until next time, this is Ben Greenfield and the Kombucha Mama signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com.
Visit bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.